Our next speaker is Professor Robin Carhart-Harris, who is one of the most influential psychedelic scientists in the world. In 2020, The Times named him one of the world's top medical scientists, and the following year, he was included in Time Magazine's 100 Next list of 100 notable people poised to make history. Currently, he's a distinguished professor and director of the Neuroscape Psychedelics Division at the University of California, San Francisco, and before that, he founded and was the head of the Center for Psychedelic Research at Imperial College London.
Thanks for having me.
Great. So, Robin, the first thing I wanted to ask you about was just a little bit, giving people a bit of a sense of your backstory. You know, as a neuroscientist, there are lots of things you potentially could have researched in your career. So why psychedelics? What is it that drew you toward researching psychedelics?
Well, what to share? Yeah, I guess, you know, as a young man, I was curious going about my life, and I came across psychedelics and had some experiences that stuck with me. Really a pivotal sort of intellectual event or sequence events would have been drawn to psychology in my teens, and especially depth psychology. I guess ultimately, maybe especially people who are drawn to psychology are interested in understanding themselves, me search, as they say. So I was drawn to depth psychology because it seemed to really go deep on the mind, on the psyche. And yet I was also frustrated about its sort of lack of scientific discipline, perhaps. I could see that, notice that. I wanted to know more confidently whether the unconscious mind exists and this kind of thing. So around that, I'd formally asked in a seminar, if that's formal, whether a drug could allow us to see deeper into the psyche. And then no one knew in that seminar. They just could tell it was an interesting idea. But I then went back with the idea, you know, firmly sort of fixed in my mind, did a library search online and saw Realms of the Human Unconscious by Stanislav Grof. And ever since reading that book, my life has changed, because there it was. Psychedelics reveal the unconscious mind, or a way into the very depths of the psyche. And so in a sense, that was a light bulb moment, a kind of awakening, enlightenment moment for me, because I felt, oh, that's what the unconscious is. That's what happens when you trip. And that was my thread in. And the neuroscience sort of came later on, as I realized, you know, the tight mapping between mind and brain. And I wanted to understand what the heck's going on in the brain when we trip, and what could that tell us perhaps about the biology of phenomena of interest to depth psychology, like the ego and its dynamics with the unconscious and so on. So I know that's very abstract, but that was my way in.
Well, that's fascinating. I don't think I've actually ever heard you talk about that. So a few questions come up. I mean, the first thing I'm curious about is, as a neuroscientist now, having done a tremendous amount of very important psychedelic research, how do you view the unconscious, right? Because you're looking at what's actually happening in the brain. And so what is there a way to correlate what you're seeing in brain scans of people who, you know, on a psychedelic and unconscious activity? Is it that easy to do, or how do you approach that kind of question?
Well, it's very hard, you know, because it's a sort of intrinsically vague, abstract construct. What is the unconscious? It's hard to pin down. I guess the way I go at it is to think of the unconscious as a system, And this goes back to like Freudian metapsychology. He'd call it the system unconscious, and only later on it became the it, that was then translated into the id in English, the English translation of his work. So what is that system? Well, it's a primitive system, an archaic system, a mode of being, a mode of, you could say a mode of cognition, but it's more a mode of mind, of existing, that is primitive, that is yet to be, in a sense, stitched up and controlled and filtered through the ego and the conscious mind. It's a mode of mind that you would see in an infant, and it's a mode of mind and brain function, of course, that you would see, if you could, in sort of primitive human beings. And in a sense, you know, I mean, that's a fascinating question. When in our evolutionary development did we inhabit that state of mind? And when was there a sort of threshold point, or was it a phase in which that mode of consciousness was sort of suppressed and taken over by the chattering analytical ego mind that we're you know, inhabiting right now and do in normal waking consciousness? You know, when did that point, when was it reached evolutionarily? So anyway, yeah, I think what you can see when you look in the brain and make mappings from brain function to mind function is a mapping between the loss of the ego mind, of ego consciousness. That's something that we can make mappings from, you know, subjective ratings and maybe some behavioral stuff as well to brain function. And of course, we're feeling our way in the dark because it's such a hard problem, but it's not like we have nothing to go on now. Like, we do have some insight.
Well, so it'd be really interesting to hear then what is actually happening in the brain when we take, for example, psilocybin, the active ingredient in magic mushrooms, because I know some of your research into this is quite pioneering, and I think it's very useful for people to get a sense of what's going on, and then perhaps how it relates to our sense of an egoic self, why that matters. Why is that so healing potentially?
Oh, yeah. Well, I guess that's another angle, that it's healing at all. But, you know, if we go to the more fundamental question, what's going on in the brain, whether it's a good or a bad thing, it depends on the lens that we're looking at brain function. And we're always seeing the brain through a lens, something I didn't fully appreciate when I first got into neuroscience, but we're very much limited by the resolution, the scope of our tools. And so we've got a couple of powerful tools, at least, to look at brain function. One is an old technology that goes back to the 20s, electrophysiology, EEG, the kind of swimming cap things that you see on people's heads, and lots of sensors often. And they're recording through the scalp, electrical activity underneath from the brain. You can detect it, which is pretty remarkable. And so we can look at changes in the quality of that ongoing brain activity under a psychedelic. And when we do, perhaps the most robust and reliable finding in psychedelic brain imaging is an increase in the signal complexity or entropy of brain activity. Ongoing brain activity under a psychedelic, it very markedly goes up. It tracks with the intensity of the trip. Recently, we've seen that it tracks especially strongly with people's ratings of the richness of content of conscious experience. So it's like the more bits in your conscious experience, the more bits in the brain activity. That's cool because, you know, that's a pretty recent finding. We first published on it about 5 or 6 years ago. And until we'd shown that, that brain entropy or complexity goes up under these drugs, under psychedelics, we thought that brain entropy or complexity more or less topped out in normal waking consciousness. You know, and brain entropy does increase as we age and mature, almost as if we're bringing more depth and complexity into our conscious experience as we mature, you know, even into our 60s, brain complexity is going up. But it's also cool because most interventions, psychoactive interventions, that typically dull conscious content and experience drop brain entropy. So anesthetics do this very reliably and dose dependently. Recently, it's been found that stimulants don't increase brain entropy. So it's not a simple arousal thing. Even THC doesn't do it. My view, yeah, it's quite a profound altered state of consciousness to be stoned on THC in cannabis, but it's not strictly, in my book, a psychedelic. It's close. It's psychedelic-like, but not really a classic psychedelic like LSD or psilocybin. So that's interesting. So there's a degree of specificity now as well. And very excitingly, some recent findings, we've seen that that entropic brain effect, as I call it, is predictive of changes in people's psychological presentation and more specifically, changes in their mental health 1 month later. So you can look at brain entropy changing under the drug, potentially in real time, like in a matter of minutes, and predict how someone's mental health is going to, in this case, improve 1 month after the psychedelic. This is with psilocybin. That's pretty cool because, you know, all of a sudden it's taking us onto potentially firmer ground, more objective biological ground in terms of understanding, yeah, now we're going to therapeutic action. How can you change someone, you know, how to change your mind? This could be a sort of biological account, at least part of the picture for how you can change the mind. So that's cool. There's other, you know, if we look through the lens of fMRI and we can see with fine-grained spatial resolution, millimeter resolution now, different brain systems and networks and their dynamics. So we're moving away from that sort of phrenology-like approach to brain function. This region does this. You know, I think in time, we realize that a given region does, you know, a million things and there's a lack of specificity there. So now we're better understanding brain networks or systems that are distributed across the brain and understanding their dynamics across time. So I believe we're getting closer to making mappings between brain function and experience that are, you know, more compelling, more satisfactory than that old sort of phrenology approach of like turning on the, you know, I don't know, the God experience through activating the God region, something silly like that, you know, the pineal gland or whatever. That's kind of nonsense, sort of pseudoscience. Now we're thinking and learning that certain systems that are associated with high level cognition, systems that have expanded disproportionately in our species, that especially develop through ontogeny or our development from infancy into adulthood, like the default mode network, not just the default mode network. I could explain the default mode network, but you know, this is a distributed system that, yes, has expanded massively in our species, that is tonically active in the background, hence default mode, and is associated with things like self-reflection and imagination. Once upon a time, I proposed that its functioning may relate to ego functioning. And we have found under psychedelics that the integrity of this system, not just this system, but yes, this system is included. The integrity breaks down under psychedelics. And as it breaks down within the system, it opens up and becomes more communicative with the rest of the brain. And that effect, now quite well replicated across teams, correlates with some of the abstract phenomenology of the psychedelic experience, like the unitive experience, or that sense of oneness that comes as the positive to the negative of ego dissolution. So the things are very closely related.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Thank you. There's a few threads I'd be quite keen to pick up on. One is just, I just want to give a sense of a metaphor that just came up and sense check it with you. But it seems like what I thought was very interesting is this idea that there's different brain regions which are responsible for something for each, you know, individual things is quite outdated now. And in fact, it's a much more complex system where different systems, it sounds like, in the brain are interacting and speaking to each other. Would it be safe to say that when we take a psychedelic, those systems all speak to each other in new ways, or do they speak to each other more, for example, or different systems connecting that wouldn't connect before? How does that all work?
Yeah. The honest answer is that I don't know how it all works, but we see, you know, these systems are patterns. That's one way to think of them. Yes, they have an anatomy. So you'll see fibers that are really strong from one region, say at the back of the brain, to a region at the front of the brain. There's literal, you know, cabling between those regions. But they're also, you know, patterns of activity. And when we're using something like fMRI to look at these systems, that's what we're looking at. We're looking at these patterns, and they sort of come into prominence and then fade, and another system comes in and then fades. And so those are the kind of dynamics. And what we see under psychedelics actually is that there's a global pattern that seems to be more prominent. We've seen this under DMT, LSD, psilocybin. It's sort of a globally undifferentiated pattern. It's almost patternless. it probably does have patterns, but they're very granular, and so higher spatial resolution. So that's what we're seeing. And what we're also seeing is that patterns that are quite prominent in normal waking consciousness, like the default mode pattern that will come in, these regions being synchronous in time, going up and down together in their activity, that pattern is diminished. The brain doesn't reside in that pattern. And for people who are familiar with this term of attractors, like attraction, like an attractor beam, you know, or imagine a landscape with a literal depression, or depression in that landscape, and you've got a marble rolling in it. You know, if it gets near the zone of the depression, it's inclined to fall into the bottom of it. You know, that's an attractor. So these patterns are a little bit like that. It can have a kind of gravitational pull. And maybe in certain psychiatric disorders or mental illnesses, certain patterns may have an excessive gravitational pull, and we can get stuck in them. But under psychedelics, it seems that these attractors, these patterns, are less attracting in a sense. It's as if the landscape sort of flattens out and the dynamics are more flexible within that landscape. Yeah,
I think I've heard you use the phrase of sort of that psychedelics might open a kind of window of plasticity, right? So a time in which new connections might be able to be made. And I think this idea of neuroplasticity is a really interesting one to talk about, because It seems very important. So maybe could you define what is neuroplasticity and how does it relate to psychedelics?
Yeah. Well, I quite like the dictionary definition of plasticity without the neuro bit, which means the ability to be shaped or molded. So it's changeability, malleability. These are synonyms for plasticity. That's what plasticity is in its purest sense. It's not a change per se, but changeability. How easy is it to change? So you think of a plastic material, you know, malleable, like plasticine. So that's plasticity. Neuroplasticity is kind of hijacked plasticity. And through the experiments that have been done and the way that we look at plasticity has almost become an index of literal change and specifically anatomical change, especially. So things like the strengthening of certain circuits or connections and the growth of certain aspects of neurons. That's become a kind of favored index of neuroplasticity. If you were to look up a definition of neuroplasticity, you might see something like the ability of the brain to reorganize itself. So it's not a million miles away from changeability in the brain. And that's how we should think of it. It's just that through our measures, which become operational definitions, we've become quite wedded to a certain type of neuroplasticity. It's called Hebbian plasticity. People might be familiar with this term, cells that fire together, wire together. That's been associated with Hebb because it's similar to the work that he did, but he never actually used that phrase, which is curious. But anyway, it is this sort of potentiation or strengthening of certain circuitry. That's Hebbian plasticity. The problem I have with our weddedness to Hebbian plasticity in neuroscience is that I'm not confident that psychedelics do that. And actually, you know, many drugs of abuse do that, like cocaine and other stimulants, a bunch of, you know, hedonic drugs, alcohol, opiates. They strengthen certain circuitry, actually the reward circuitry. But psychedelics don't really do that. If anything, they do the inverse of that. They sort of weaken and weaken specificity and broaden possibility. So that's why I think it's quite important to be specific about the action of psychedelics on plasticity. You know, and I would say that I do think psychedelics promote plasticity in that dictionary definition sense of the ability to be shaped or molded or changeability. But it's not that Hebbian plasticity thing that neuroscience has sort of, you know, run with and sort of co-opted the meaning of plasticity to specifically mean Hebbian plasticity. Anyway, you can tell it's a bit of a bugbear, but I felt it necessary to sort of give that first formal definition of plasticity in its purest sense. And
yeah, no, I think it's actually quite important because there's a big difference between sort of kind of tightening wiring and just metaphorically and embedding something. Even the subjective experience of that, like let's say if I start learning how to play guitar and I'm getting the muscle memory and I'm getting really into it, there is at least subjectively in my experience and you know a lot of people I've seen in retreats, for example, of an opening up and people saying, you know, reporting afterwards, oh, I have a sense of spaciousness. If there's one word actually I've heard the most from people after retreats, it's space, spaciousness, some sense of possibility and of expansion. So I'm curious about, you know, how that might relate to something you mentioned earlier, which is people having potentially lasting changes, let's say a month later from, you know, from a psychedelic experience. What might be going on, or like, where's your thinking right now on what might be going on that someone might go in with, say, depression, and then a month later be their symptoms are much lessened and they have a different perspective. Be good to hear you talk about that.
Yeah, sure, happy to. So, you know, again, I come back to that landscape, and so people I could invite, you know, to have in their mind's eye a vision of a landscape, and within that landscape, you know, again, imagine this literal depression like a dark hole, you know. And let's think of depression and how to fall into a depressive episode is like falling into that dark hole. You know, it sucks you in, and it's hard to get out of. And if you have chronic recurrent depression, like treatment resistant depression, it's all too easy to fall back into it. Maybe there are triggers for someone with that presentation that draw them into the depressive episode that wouldn't draw a healthy sort of resilient person so easily, you know, into that mode, into that state. So I think that's what, you know, a lot of psychopathology is. In fact, recently I proposed it's the main thing of mental illness is the over potentiation or over strengthening of certain substates of mind and brain and behavior that get over reinforced, and maybe the practice that reinforces them is often implicit, like we're not conscious of it, but we're practicing on, say, in depression, you know, negative thoughts about ourselves, negative thoughts about the world, that's a kind of internal chatter that is all the time kind of reinforcing the problematic pattern, you know. And the term I use is canalization, which comes from evolutionary science, and formally it's the inverse of plasticity, where in evolutionary science they treat plasticity, you know, consistently in a manner that's consistent with this dictionary definition of the ability to be shaped or molded. So that's like a phenotype, a property of an organism becoming more sensitive to its environment, more plastic, more changeable. The opposite of that is a phenotype or property of an organism that gets stamped in and becomes resistant to anything that's happening in its environment. Like a depressed person, you know, gets very lucky in some way and doesn't notice, you know, they're blind to it because of the way they've reinforced their negativity. They are canalized, they're resistant to environmental information. Now, I think what psychedelics do, and I sort of feel increasingly confident about this, is that in opening up the landscape, and they do this through that entropic action, I think, through dysregulating, it's a bit jargony, but statistical regularities in brain function, through increasing noise in a system, or like increasing temperature that makes molecules, you know, move around with more motion. The psychedelic is dysregulating, but the function of that is to weaken patterns that have become over reinforced. And so it is that window of plasticity. It's that opportunity for revision, for maybe deweighting these patterns that have become overweighted. And, you know, through the acute or short-term immediate relaxation of those patterns, deweighting of those patterns, there's that fresh opportunity for change. There's more to the picture than just that. I think you need to twin that with psychological support, you know, nurturing, supportive conditions, such that when you open someone up, they're vulnerable and they need to be cared for, you know, like an open, unsuspecting child, you know, needs to be cared for. It's vulnerable. We have a responsibility there to do that care. And it's a similar sort of, you know, scenario with psychedelics, I think. So those are some ideas. There's more, of course, there's always more You know, one question that really intrigues me is, what is the apparent insight that people have under psychedelics? You know, psychedelic means psyche revealing, making the soul manifest or visible. So what's going on in the brain when people say, like, ah, I get it now. Oh, I can see how these things happened in my life. And then I probably kind of, I don't know, went inside and ruminated too much. And then actually, yeah, I developed that habit, and that was kind of an unhealthy habit. And maybe I did that because of a way to forget or something, you know. Why do they have that insight is a fascinating question. There's a couple of ideas, you know. It's almost as if there might be more, you know, it's like if we think of it in computational terms, it's like a data decompression. It's like cracking a file that was compressed up, reduced in a sense, and is now allowed to open back up, and we can see all the information that before had been kind of reduced down and suppressed from awareness. So there's like insight and ability to see granularity that before had been suppressed away through the sort of, you know, reducing function of maybe, you know, ego consciousness. There's that, and there's also a kind of analogy of like the overview effect, like an astronaut, you know, up in space looking back on the Earth and then seeing the bigger picture and being able to put things in perspective. So it's a bit of a paradox there, because it's like, oh, one aspect of the insight is seeing more granularity, data decompressed, information suppressed out that is now available again. But the other one is sort of seeing a really vast bigger picture. So it's funny that you can sort of have insight in those two different ways.
Yeah, it just really fascinates me. Also, the other thing that comes up for me hearing you describe that is this increase of complexity in the brain and all this stuff happening, and then subjectively, very often there is an awful lot going on subjectively. There's imagery, there's memories, there's feelings, but there can be a very rich coherence, a sense of purpose and a sense of directionality and a sense of a kind of story that we might be going through within ourselves in that process. And that, I find that absolutely fascinating. That also seems a bit like a kind of juxtaposition between the two things. So the last thing I wanted to ask you about was what you're most excited about, you know, in the research right now. And obviously there's been a lot of headway in clinical research and in, you know, helping people who might be suffering from, for example, depression, you've talked about. And there's also, of course, research to creativity and, you know, chronic pain now at Imperial. And, you know, there's lots of other areas as well. So I'm curious about what's exciting you the most.
Well, it's a hard question because there's so much. You know, I was sort of ping-ponging around in my head about what I could say, because there's a lot that's interesting. So I don't think it would be like one indication, you know, because that's a game in a sense that everyone's playing, which is a bit of a glib way to put it. But there's a lot of different psychiatric disorders and beyond that could and is already showing signal with psychedelic therapy. So yeah, anorexia, chronic pain, bunch of addiction disorders. We'll see some impressive results come out with psilocybin therapy for cocaine use disorder shortly. There's going to be, you know, might be today, a paper coming out with amazing results in bipolar 2. So, you know, people with depression, but also having sort of hypermanic episodes, really frank sort of psychotic manic episodes, but a sort of attenuated version of that, and amazing results. I think 12 of 15 reaching criteria for remission being symptom free at 12 weeks. 12 or 15, that's better than any, it's a very small study, but it's better than current response and remission rates, say with psilocybin in therapy and depression. So there's all that promise, and it's real. And, you know, I'm of the view that there's something actually happening here with the treatment that goes beyond a mere placebo response. That whole chestnut, the idea that this is all being carried by a breaking of blind and positive expectancy. You know, we've assessed that by measuring expectancy pre-trial and seeing that it wasn't predictive of response to psilocybin therapy in depression. Whereas flip it another way, in that trial that I'm referring to, you know, the other arm got escitalopram, SSRI, conventional antidepressant. Pre-trial expectancy for that did predict quite reliably response to the escitalopram, to the SSRI. So what am I most excited about? you know, I proposed that entropic brain thing in 2014. I wrote my first paper on it, which is a kind of entropic paper in itself. It's a little bit all over the place. Bunch of ideas went into it. It sort of matured over time, for better or worse. But it's, I think it's holding up. So I'm excited about that. I think it can tell us something about therapeutic action of psychedelics in treating psychiatric disorder. Maybe it could tell us something even beyond psychiatric illness in terms of how to elevate or help even neurological disorders through inducing functional plasticity, and then twinning that with some kind of training, some rehab. I'm fascinated by that possibility. And what it can tell us about consciousness. If, as I'm proposing, really that hypothesis states that the entropy of spontaneous brain activity reads out on the richness of content of conscious experience. So if that holds, then that's pretty cool. That's pretty exciting. Yeah. And I think, especially given where we are with, you know, other theories of consciousness, quite recently the integrated information theory of consciousness came in for a hard time from some peers in the neuroscience community. A little bit uncivil, I felt, how that all played out, accused of being pseudoscientific and so on. But I do wonder, and a bit of a daring time to come in and say something like this, but I do wonder whether the meat that's on the bone is in the entropic brain effect, you know, that does track with richness of content of conscious experience. And the integration component may be sort of wrapped in, such that, for example, you could overshoot with an entropic brain effect and lose some aspect of consciousness. I'm not sure you would lose consciousness per se, but you might lose the ability to report back on what actually you experienced. That the content was so rich that it was sort of everything. And so how to put that into words is a challenge, but people wouldn't describe that as being a full loss of consciousness like they might have with an anesthetic. They might use sort of fuzzy terms like pure consciousness, or a sense of oneness again, or the interconnectedness of all things. And I know this is horribly abstract now, but it is a very interesting question of, like, where does that entropic brain top out? If it does track with richness of conscious experience, is there an upper bound to that, above which you lose some aspect of how we typically understand consciousness?
Yeah, no, I mean, and it might be somewhat abstract, but it also I think points to one of the most important questions that human beings ask, you know, what is consciousness? So I'm also very excited to see where the research, what it might point us towards in the coming years. So Robin, this has been really rich, entropically rich and really fascinating. So I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Thanks, Sally.